It's time for Magnuson Nature News, a monthly program about the amazing nature inside Magnuson Park. Each episode has a different theme, featuring animals or plants that live here in the park. You'll hear fascinating facts and true nature stories, interviews with kids or adults who know a lot about nature, the best places inside Magnuson Park to find animals and plants, and much, much more. Magnuson Nature News is brought to you by Magnuson Children's Garden, a great place for the whole family to visit any month of the year, and where all of our events are free. I'm your host, Emily Bishton, and I'd like to give a special welcome to all kids and adults who know me from my years of teaching at Magnuson Children's Garden, Magnuson Nature Programs, and the Jane Addams Sandpoint and Dunlap School Gardens. Magnuson Children's Garden is delighted to be a part of Space 101.1 FM and hope you enjoy this edition of Magnuson Nature News. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. I'm really delighted to have Chris Anderson from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife is our special guest, and he is a wildlife biologist that specializes in bats, our creature of the month.
Welcome to the radio show, Chris.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. Yeah, really appreciate it. So I know that you are an expert about bats, and that's the theme of our show this month. So the first question I have for you is, what are some of your favorite fascinating facts about bats?
Well, we have technically, in my personal opinion, 14 species of bats in Washington, but on the books we still have 15. So we have a quite diverse species of bat here in Washington.
What do you mean by 15 species on the books?
The King's myotis, or myotis meaning the mouse-eared bats that are in Washington, all insectivorous. It has recently, some genetic work has shown that it should likely be lumped with the long-eared bat, so our western long-eared. But it hasn't quite made its way into regulation yet and things like
mm-hmm.
that. But, some of the interesting things that I like about bats, well, here, all of our bats are insectivorous, so eat insects in the state of Washington. They can eat up to half their body weight generally in an evening.
Half their body weight? Wow. That's like me eating 10 gallons of ice cream a day.
You know, you're looking at, a colony of bats eating tons of insects just in one season. So they're extreme insect consumers, predators, and really control insects as well, better than in the case of pest insects, better than any pesticide out there. Some studies, for example, I give this in a lot of talks, that for example, one study out of California, they found that for apple coddling moth, a bat colony roost within 1 mile of some of the orchards there, they were finding less than 5% moth damage.
That's amazing. Apple coddling moth is one of the insects in an orchard that can do the most damage to our fruit.
And the other thing about that is with pesticides, you're usually looking at 30% reduction. So you have something that is increasing and decreasing the damage to almost nothing. And that's one study, but there are other studies out there that have illustrated that. So you're looking at an animal that contributes hugely to the success of our agriculture economy when it comes to crops and pests.
Yeah, and besides not having to use pesticides in the potential damage they do to the environment, but bats provide pest control for free.
Correct.
And
yeah.
That's a huge benefit to all the farmers and farming companies out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
All they need to do is support their limiting needs. So, you know, and ensure they have, they keep wetlands around for water sources and you know, meet their water needs that way, and provide trees for areas where they have migratory corridors, and some species like to forage along the edges or canopy tops of trees, and provide then dying trees and also enhancements where you can as well, as far as, you know, as far as things like bat boxes, proper bat boxes. Bats Northwest is a local nonprofit that has good guidance on bat boxes, size, type, where to put it. We have some of that at our Backyard Wildlife Sanctuary website at Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife's main website. And also everybody's familiar with Bat Conservation International, which has some guidance for that as well. The big thing is we're heat limited here on the west side of the crest, and these animals tend to like it hotter than our ambient temperatures, even in the summer. So you want to get something that's nice and tight and dark, and also is sizable enough for them, the little tiny 12-inch to 15-inch by 9 or 12-inch boxes you see in some stores are not worth it, unfortunately. So generally not taken to. So you want something that's a little more substantial and has you're thinking like a bat and trying to reproduce something like a dead or dying tree, the same kind of structure, for example.
And in the past few years, there have been multiple of the rocket box style bat boxes go up in the wetlands, built by local scouts, and at Promontory Point at Magnuson, and also in the children's garden we have a two boxes that are what they call the Uncle Charlie style. Both of those were recommended by Bats Northwest, and we haven't really had colony take up residency during any time of the year yet, but we did make them according to those instructions, and they're all painted black and sealed real well. We're still hopeful that we'll be able to do that at Magnuson to increase their habitat.
Sure. Well, and that's common. That's just like with bird boxes. I mean, you're providing something as best you can to try and mimic their preferences and microclimatic needs and conditions there, but it's no guarantee. I mean, you know, you can't get in the mind of that animal. And further, you know, with bats, you have an animal that's very long-lived, slow breeding in comparison to a lot of other animals. So the thing about, you know, putting up structures for bats, you know, man-made structures, is just like when we do that for other wildlife. We're doing our best to mimic what they would prefer in nature, and it doesn't always work. And, you know, we're getting into the mind sort of those animals. What have I seen? You know, one way to really do that well is to observe these animals in their habitat, watch how they use it, and then consider reproducing that in areas where that habitat isn't as good, could be enhanced. You've lost some of that habitat. In the case of bats, you know, when they're roosting, they tend to roost, you know, dead dying trees, things like that. So mimicking that via like rocket boxes and other bat boxes that are appropriate is a good effort, but no guarantees are going to come. You got an animal that lives 10 to 40 years in various published articles and very set in its ways. If it still has all the various roosts that it prefers, There's little reason for it to filter its way into something new that we put up. We usually have something like that where if there's a nearby colony and it's gotten too big for itself, so to speak, or there's been habitat loss and you know you have bats in the area, you've seen them or detected them, if you have an acoustic detector, you know there's bat population around, that's when we tend to see rocket boxes and other bat boxes. Utilized because they have lost that habitat, or things have been altered, or they've gotten too big for themselves. It's like a maternity colony, and they're seeking out spaces to use. Or even the young at maternity colonies. Sometimes you'll see them show up in rocket boxes at the end of the season because they're flighted, volant, and they're checking out all those spaces, and they will sometimes show up. I've seen that in their colonies. All of a sudden, you know, they're there for a little bit and just utilizing it, and they're getting their wings, so to speak. So,
right.
But, yeah.
Well, we'll just have to keep an eye on all the boxes at Magnuson and just keep watching them and see if there's any signs that bats are using them.
Yep. And you know, they can sometimes, you know, it can be very fleeting. You could have an individual or individuals that use them for a few days due to various reasons, weather conditions, and then, oh, here's my shelter, and it's not on the normal circuit, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that would be something very difficult to detect. So, but it happens. So,
yeah. Well, what are some of the things besides habitat loss that are threats to bats in the Northwest right now?
One of the biggest things that comes to mind is the disease, white nose syndrome, that we have in bats here in Washington. It's been in North America since the winter of 2005-2006 there, when it was first detected there in 2006, that early winter spring, out in New York, actually. And scientists have determined that it's a non-native invasive fungus species, big word, Pseudogymnascus destructens, or P as in Paul, D as in David, in short. So it's this cold, wet-loving fungus that causes this in certain species of bats. That fungus they found is native to Eurasia, particularly places like Central Europe, Eastern China. And they found it on other bats there. They found it in the soil. They found it on specimens in museums. So it's been there a while. It does affect some species of bats over there, but it doesn't seem to be lethal or as lethal as what we have here, where we see upwards of 90% lethal outcome in our native bats in North America. In Washington, unfortunately, back in the winter, spring of 2016, so winter of 15-16, which is, and I want to stipulate why I'm mentioning the across-year winter there, so that winter of 2015 into early winter of 16, in winter is when we normally see, is when we see these animals affected by that fungus, which then can cause white nose syndrome. So the fungus itself doesn't always cause this disease. Some species are not affected, has to be in the right situation. But those animals can still move it around, even species like, for example, our Townsend's Biggard bat, which has been found to spread that, to have that fungus on it. It does not come down with it. It's not been documented yet, as do a number of other related species to that species, the Townsend's Biggard bat. But it still can spread it around.
That's kind of like how people can also spread a cold or flu germs without actually being sick themselves.
And if it has it on it, many bats, they have very high preference for the same kind of microclimates for roosting. So if there's a Motel 6 open for the big brown or the little brown that can come down with it, and no one's home or there's enough space, and we have, for example, a Townsend's bigger bat out and about and needs to seek shelter and have a nice thermoregulatory environment for it to maximize its processes. It shows up and it came from a roost where it picked up that fungus, deposits it in that spot. And then from there is ample opportunity for other bats to move it about, including ones that can come down with it in winter. And the fungus then creates white nose syndrome in the appropriate, the known species of bats, or in some cases, new to announcements has come to Washington there in March 2016. So assumingly the bat that was found at that time, which was a little brown bat out in the North Bend, got that in, succumbed to that in a winter roost. And as it came out, as it emerged, it was not doing well. It perished on the landscape and luckily, but unluckily, was found. And so it's usually bat-to-bat spread, but it has been documented that the fungus can be spread around by humans as well. And also bats tuck into human things too, and they can be spread around by us, and then they meet up with, you know, they find their ways into these preferred areas or socially with other bats, and the fungus can be spread that way. So there's a number of pathways for the fungus to be moved around that then has the potential to cause the disease, white nose syndrome, and the right species of bats
So does that mean that when scientists like yourself are studying bats or close to bats, you have to take precaution that you are not accidentally transmitting any fungal spores?
Yes, absolutely. We are doing everything we can to reduce any fungal load on us or equipment or in my vehicle, for example. You know, taking precautions, wearing appropriate protective disposable clothing like Tyvek suits. You know, there's decontamination measures that are outlined. There's a great collaborative website amongst academic entities and government called whitenosesyndrome.org. There's a link off of our state whitenosesyndrome webpage as well, and it goes through the federally accepted recommendations for decontamination. And so we follow that in the state of Washington, and we work even with volunteers. We also have them, you know, conduct that decontamination in proper situations. If you're going into a roost, you have to take some sort of decontamination measure.
How does the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife interact with government and nonprofit agencies to share info about white nose syndrome and to find solutions?
Well, two of the main collaborative efforts that we are in, both with federal government entities, academia, nonprofits, tribal entities, is sharing the workload, for one. Capacity at all levels tends to be not quite enough. So, you know, if we can help one entity find funding or vice versa and find the ability to have staff capacity to monitor or provide data for tests. For example, we have worked with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the U.S. Forest Service and USGS, National Wildlife Health Center, to obtain grants and then work with them and academic entities to provide data for further study. We found in working with a lot of those entities in Washington. Do get some looks in King County, Washington here, when we emerge from under a bridge or something and we're wearing Tyvek, and people, many times I get asked, was there a spill? Am I going to get sick? What's wrong?
Right.
The first thing we say is, no, we're here, wildlife study, we're working, you know, and then we explain to them about white nose syndrome and that it's due to this fungus, PD, and what's happened in Washington. We were really the first documented jump of this disease. It had been really point spread across eastern North America, including that area of Canada, since 2006 when it was formally documented out there in New York. And it was at a line about Minnesota in 2015, 2016 there, and all of a sudden it was discovered here in March 2016. So we were the first documented known jump at this point spread, which was bound to happen at some point, unfortunately.
So can you tell a little bit about how the Washington State Fish and Wildlife staff kind of does public education for citizens as well as for governmental agencies? And we, you know, really appreciated having you on our bat walk at the end of July. And I know that, you know, the people who came to that were so happy to, you know, be able to get their questions answered in person by an expert. But how do you reach out to the kind of the public in general?
Well, that's one way, through various types of outreach. That particular event at Magnuson, it was a great time. We had a great group of people. It was just nice to be out, have a nice evening, saw all kinds of things, beaver, birds, bats. But here in WDFW, that's one way, is a lot of outreach. We've worked with the media and newspapers. Even when it first came here, we were running page ads as far as have you found dead bats, et cetera. We have a white nose syndrome coordinator, Abby Tobin, who's down in Olympia, and she's obviously focused solely on white nose syndrome and bats and bat conservation with this. And so we work a little area bios like myself. We work heavily with Abby and work with her to develop and vet with both internally and across other government agencies our efforts with white nose syndrome. And so one thing outside of outreach is we have developed a website, which is at wdfw.wa.gov, our white nose syndrome website.
And so if people go, if people do find a sick or a dead bat, they could go to your website and find that form.
Yeah, they can find that form, and also we're also looking for, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That allows them to report that to you, and then someone will contact them.
Correct, yeah. And also there's a link to a similar form of reporting groups of bats that are observed. And we're interested in any groups of bats. Doesn't have to be a maternity colony. Doesn't have to be a hibernation site. It can be I have five bats above my door, and they are
right
here sometimes, and they're gone. We're interested in that, too. This is how we're passively monitoring these animals now, because we don't know where most of our bats in Washington go to hibernate. So one place that I recommend folks, if you're listening to the radio program right now and you want to learn more about white nose syndrome, is just to go to put in a search engine, WDFW white nose syndrome, and you'll be taken right to our state page, which has links to other pages like the whitenosesyndrome.org page I'd mentioned. Has links to learning about how to decontaminate, also how to report groups of bats, dead or sick bats, and also checking out other entities that have the same type of information.
Wow, I have learned so much about bats today, and really appreciate you taking the time to let me interview you. And I can tell right now that this is enough for two radio shows. So I think you're going to be our guest next month, too, with the part two of this interview that we've done today. And, Chris, I just thanks again for helping us at the July 27th Bat Walk at the Wetlands here at Magnuson, and also just for all you're doing on behalf of the bats of Washington. It's really important work, and very happy to have people like you doing it.
Well, we try our best and just doing my job, but I appreciate everyone's interest. I appreciate that we have a children's garden out there in Madison, and also that we have a park that's so nice, like that urban park. It's fantastic. Do what you can for your local parks. These are the areas, particularly in urban areas, that provide for our urban wildlife. And spending our time out there is valuable. I mean, more and more studies are showing that this outdoor time, regardless where it's at, doesn't have to be in the middle of the wilderness. It really provides, needs for humans just in our own life needs. I mean, people are less stressed. They do better. So kudos to Seattle Parks and other entities that are acquiring those spaces and managing them and keeping them around for our benefit. So, and I appreciate that we have those resources both for bats but for us as well.
Kudos to all the volunteers who help, restore habitat and create new habitat in our parks and natural areas. Seattle Parks has had just thousands and thousands of wonderful volunteers that are making a difference for all of us.
Most definitely. That's the only way to get it done.
Chris is right. It does take volunteers to get it done. And I'm sure many of you volunteer already in your local schools or community centers or nonprofit organizations. It really does get things done in this world. And it really does help all the professionals out there that are working hard for wildlife and for humans and the health of the planet. If you'd like to explore the website that Chris mentioned, www.wdfw.wa.gov. You will find all sorts of links there to the white nose syndrome, to just interesting bat facts of all kinds, and actually links to interesting facts about every kind of wildlife. It's a fabulous website. And if you're interested, especially in bats, visit batsnorthwest.org. That is also a wonderful website, great nonprofit, and free plans you can download for either the Rocket Box or the Uncle Charlie type of bat boxes. So really fun reading in all sorts of ways. And besides visiting our Facebook page at facebook.com Magnuson Children's Garden, I'd like to invite everyone to subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter. The Children's Garden has an e-newsletter called Magnuson Nature News that comes out at the beginning of every month. And it's a free newsletter. It contains information about our upcoming events. It also contains always an article about this month's radio show with direct links to the websites that are mentioned on the show. Well, that's all for this month. Hope to see you in the park.